welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
Oh, Carrie, it's hot here, so if I say anything strange, it's because...
Your brain is melted?
Yeah, you know, all of those... Well, you lived here for a while. You must have seen a local news segment where they fried eggs on asphalt. Or on the... What is it? Like the... Not the roof of the car, but like the dashboard?
Yep.
Yeah.
Or cookies.
Yep.
They would bake cookies in the car.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Yeah. One of my favorite parts of watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver are all of the amazing local news clips.
I know. They're so good.
And this is out of respect because I grew up watching local news. I worked at, you know, the School of Journalism at ASU, and I get to see, like, people that I, you know, students, that people that were once students there doing local news stuff, and it's great, and it's really important work. Oh my god, though, some of the things they make you do. cheesy things. But yeah, that's the big thing. If people don't know, maybe you're in somewhere that isn't frightfully hot. Yeah, the big thing here is to fry things on our hot surfaces during the summer. So.
Yeah, because every year people are like, wow, how is it this hot?
Oh, I think it's a matter of survival. Our brains have to forget that we survive it every summer.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, last summer I realized I can't do this anymore. And I was grateful that Chris had already been like, maybe we should move to Canada.
Yeah.
Because last summer was so brutal. Mm-hmm. I couldn't wait to get somewhere cooler.
Yeah.
Speaking of cooler.
Yeah. Yes, please. Maybe it'll make me feel better somehow.
Speaking of Chris, we were planning on going to Stanley Park and walking along the seawall, which is like about a 2-hour walk. Sounds lovely, and it usually is lovely, but of course it's raining today, which brings up something that I wanted to bring up, that in Vancouver, June is often called Junuary because it's so rainy, and everyone's like, why is it so rainy? It should be summer.
Wait a second. There are real people in Vancouver that will say out loud to another person, it's basically Junuary. Why is it
Yeah,
Junuary?
It's a real thing.
Wow.
It's Junuary, yeah. Yep, so that's what it is, and that's why we're suffering through rain. I mean, this is just the thing that happens in every June. Yesterday was kind of mixed, but at least somewhat sunny and was not raining until pretty late. But yeah, today it's just raining and probably not going to go to the seawall.
Well, I'm glad that you introduced me to it because I love... Well, I guess that's technically a portmanteau.
Yeah, or a blend.
Yeah, I like blend. I like the word blend better just because I feel like it's more, I don't know.
Transparent?
So transparent. But yeah, a blended word, those are my favorite new words. Can't help it.
I love blends.
Yeah.
I love them. I mean, some I don't like. Like, I don't really like mompreneur, because I think, actually it's mompreneur. Just doesn't like flow off the tongue, and I just feel like it doesn't have the right stress pattern, and so I don't like it. But the ones that like... really blend well, I love.
Like chocoholic.
Chocoholic's pretty good.
The sounds sound okay in English, but mompreneur doesn't feel right at all.
No, it's because it doesn't have the right stress pattern. It doesn't have the right number of syllables, that's why. So that's why I even added the tr in there to make it fit better.
Yeah, you did. Didn't work. It didn't work.
No, it didn't. Because it's not the word.
Yeah.
But anyway... But yeah. Speaking of aholic, that always makes me think of Homer Simpson when he's like, oh, I'm a rageaholic. I'm addicted to rageahol.
Oh, my God. Some of the most iconic lines.
I know.
There's also, and then my Simpsons, that's not true, though. I mean, The Simpsons is like as old as I am, literally. So I did watch it growing up, but it's like Bob's Burgers is my Simpsons, which is also some very iconic stuff coming out of that.
But yeah, it kind of is the more modern Simpsons.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's basically what I've been doing all, since it's been over 100 degrees, is watching all of Bob's Burgers over and over.
It's a solid show.
It is.
You could easily pick a worse, like, way easy to pick a worse show and still enjoy it.
It's true.
You know what I mean?
Yes. So. Yes, I do.
Kind of a lot of embedded negatives in there, but anyway... So the other thing I wanted to bring up in this intro, yesterday I was watching The Aftermath with Leah Remini and Mike Rinder. It's about Scientology. This episode that I just watched was about the Nation of Islam and how Scientology had infiltrated the Nation of Islam like over 10 years ago. And it's basically now like they're now Scientologists, and I had no idea.
I had no idea either. What?
Yeah. Look it up.
In the show, wild. Has some stuff about it.
Yeah, that episode. There's one episode that's exactly all about that, and they interview, I think, mostly former members of Nation of Islam from their perspective, like what happened and why did they leave the Nation of Islam.
And they're currently members of Scientology, or they're not?
No,
you couldn't speak
no,
to.
No, no, no,
yeah,
no.
Okay, you couldn't.
You would never. Right. They would a current Scientologist would never be on that show.
Right.
Like, that is against Scientology. You would be considered to be a trouble source or a suppressive person or whatever. Like, no, yeah. You could not be on that show.
Well, that just happens to be directly related to our episode today.
Exactly. That's exactly why I wanted to bring it up, because I was like, A, how did I never hear about this?
Right.
The Nation of Islam was, like, infiltrated by Scientology.
Right.
And then B, it also, yeah, ties in because in this episode, our guest, Amanda Montel, mentions that most members of cults are middle class white people.
Right.
And then the Nation of Islam is definitely not that. So it's like maybe the second or one of the very few counterexamples. She brings up another one in the episode. But yeah, I was like, what? A, how did I not know? And then B, also, it's so wild because, yeah, they're not white. And
right.
They're explicitly segregationist. They don't want to have anything to do with white people, which
yeah.
You can blame them.
Right,
And then, and then they're, like, joining with this super white church that is, like, against all other religions, like, you know, like, doesn't, like, Allah and everything, it's all wrong and bad, like, I don't know, my brain was just blown. I was like, what is happening?
Well, yeah, I mean, cults, like, not just for white people, I guess, I mean.
Yes, absolutely.
Mostly.
Not just for white people. But also, like, so they talk briefly about, like, why the Nation of Islam would have been okay with this happening, and it still doesn't really make that much sense to me, because, okay, yeah, they're explicitly segregationist, and then this super white church is like, hey, why don't we, like, join forces and, like, help, quote, help the community.
Right.
One of the former members of the Nation of Islam says, oh, well, you know, you make money when someone joins Scientology. Every person you bring into Scientology who pays for things, you get like 10 or 15% of that. So it's a way for them to make money.
Of course. Absolutely.
That's the people at the top of the Nation of Islam.
They're making money, not the Scientologists.
If you join and then you bring people, then you get money. So that's what I'm saying. Like, the only way that it makes sense for Nation of Islam to want to join is if someone in that organization is making money. Otherwise, it doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah.
But it still doesn't make sense. Like,
no.
Like, these people are not wealthy. Most members of Nation of Islam are not wealthy. So,
right.
Like, how much money are they actually making off of this? And there's only, like, apparently around 20,000 members. So it's not huge.
The Nation
although
of
it's
Islam?
Bigger than science.
Is,
yeah,
yeah,
although it's still bigger than the number of Scientologists in the United States, according to The Aftermath. But anyway.
Right. I mean, I just think that it's more, it's all around us. Cult and cult-like behavior and literal cults.
But have you ever heard of this, where, like, a cult took over a different religion?
No.
I mean, I'm sure it's happened, and I just didn't know.
Wait,
but,
something about the Branch Davidians? Well, no, that was a person taking over, you know.
A pre-existing kind of already culty thing.
Yeah.
You just made it more culty.
Yeah. That's the only thing
I can
think of.
A little different.
Yeah.
Because, like, that's kind of what David Miscavige did, too. Like,
yeah.
He took Scientology and made it actually worse than it already was.
But it was basically, like, white people doing it to white people and is continuing the tradition. But for this to happen is very strange. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So I understand from Scientology's perspective why they did it, because they're like, oh, we're too white. Let's bring in some people of color. Like, okay, I get their motivation. Besides also just wanting to, like, grow, because they have been shrinking for quite some time, basically ever since everyone was like, oh, Lord Xenu, that's what you believe?
Yeah.
So I get from their perspective why they did this. I just... Wow.
And then it makes you just wonder how it happened if it, you know, even if it was money, thinking about the stuff we talked about with Amanda and kind of like how these things kind of happen, how it happened, like the process, how that unfolded is, would be interesting to know one day.
I would like something, a deeper dive into what actually happened and what's still happening. Maybe, I mean, the situation may have changed in the meantime, actually, because this was 2018 when this episode came out, but
yeah,
I'd love to learn more because it makes no sense to me.
No. Talking with Amanda, you may remember Amanda from an episode a couple years ago when her other book, her first book came out, Word Slut, which is kind of like a preview of one chapter of the Vocal Fries book. Is kind of word slutty.
That's true. That's true.
But it was nice to have her on again.
Yeah, and I think that this book is even better than her first book.
Oh, it is. So, yeah. Well, I could read about this kind of stuff all day. So that might be
That's true. That's true. But still, like, she was talking about, like, her dad's experience and in a cult that I had heard of, but only for the first time last year. So Reveal, the podcast Reveal, had a 6-part episode about Synanon.
Yeah.
And I'd never heard of it before that. So at least I knew what it was. But still, like, her personal or somewhat personal connection is, like, I think really
compelling.
It is really compelling. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So
yeah.
I definitely recommend checking the book out.
Yeah, it comes out tomorrow, June 15th.
It comes out on Tuesday, the 15th.
Yes.
So yeah, please go get it.
Yeah.
If you haven't already.
It's really cool that we get to do interviews like this, because we get, what are they called? Like advanced copies of books, because, you know, people are listening to us and we really appreciate that. And if you happen to have a couple bucks extra a month that you can throw our way on Patreon, we would really appreciate it. Remember, we are an indie podcast.
Patreon.com/VocalFriesPod. And I just announced that I'm going to pay for an old transcript with because we hit a goal, well, sort of a semi-goal that I just made up. but I'm going to pay for an old episode. We still don't know which one because there had to be a tiebreaker.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll know soon which one is going to be. And every little bit helps, and we would love to have all of the old episodes transcribed.
Yes.
So, yes,
it will happen one day.
Us, the more, the closer we get to that. So, yeah, please support us, and thank you so much for those who do.
Yes, thank you. We really appreciate it.
And enjoy this episode. It is a super fun
one. Super fun,
as per usual.
Yes, we're always fun.
Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free, and they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started. Returning guest, Amanda Montel, who is a writer, language scholar, and podcast host. Her writing has been featured in Marie Claire, Glamour, Cosmopolitan, Nylon, The Rumpus, Birdie, and Who What Where, where she's formerly served as a features and beauty editor. And she's the creator and co-host of the comedy cult podcast Sounds Like a Cult, and also the author of Word Slut, a feminist guide to taking back the English language, which we had you on for that.
Yes.
And now Cultish, the language of fanaticism, about the language of cults from Scientology to Soul Cycle, which I'm so excited to talk
I'm
to you
so
about
excited.
Cults, because it's like one of my favorite topics. So thank you for coming again.
Oh my gosh, I feel right at home here.
Yes.
on the Vocal Fries podcast.
Old friends coming back onto the show. Love that.
Yeah, I remember like the first time I ever felt validated by actual like linguists, language insiders after Word Slut came out was here on the Vocal Fries podcast.
I love that. That's awesome. I love that so much. That is like an ultimate compliment.
So maybe we can, just get into it. Why did you want to write a book about cults?
Oh, well, I have always been interested in cults since before I was interested in linguistics. I mean, I came out of the womb interested in language, I think. But I grew up on these really fascinating stories that my dad would tell me. My dad spent his teenage years in this pretty notorious cult called Synanon against his will. He was forced to join by his father, who was sort of this like pseudo-intellectual, countercultural type of dude who was interested in an alternative way of living. And Synanon was this compound that started as like an alternative drug rehabilitation facility and then came to accommodate quote unquote lifestylers, people like my dad's dad who just, you know, wanted to experiment in, you know, society's social fringes. And yeah, so my dad spent his high school years living in Synanon, which was a fucking weird place. A lot of bizarre rules and protocols. Children lived separate from their parents. Everyone was forced to shave their heads at some point and break up with their spouses and get remarried to new spouses that the leader, this guy named Chuck Dietrich, had chosen. You know, classic cult stuff. And then the like centerpiece of life in Synanon was this nightly ritual called the game, where everybody had to gather around in a circle and malign one another with this like vicious personal criticism. It was pitched as group therapy, but really it was this means of social control. And as it turns out, this type of activity is not uncommon in cultish groups. Jonestown did something similar, or the People's Temple, I mean. And so anyway, I grew up on those stories. Meanwhile, my parents are research scientists, atheists. They're like not group people, they always love to tell me. And I grew up sort of like, I mean, they raised me very, very reformed Jewish just to have sort of like a cultural reference point. But I was always, always really fascinated by fanatical, fringe, supernatural belief because it was so different from what I believed. And so, you know, anthropologically, I was really pulled to groups from like tongue-speaking Pentecostal evangelicals to like sci-fi UFO doomsday type believers. And then of course I grew up really fascinated by language, and that was actually the most interesting part of my dad's stories, like the special language that they would use in Synanon, to describe life there, to, you know, create basically a shared system of understanding with this new language and to make the insiders feel special, to like instill the ideology, to shut down independent thinking, basically everything that a cult needs to do in order to generate and maintain power. And then it was like a few months before Word Slut came out that I was catching up with my best friend who had recently started going to AA. I won't reveal her name because anonymous. but she was telling me about all of the jargon, you know, there's like such a robust glossary of jargon that they use in AA. And I was like, oh my God, it's so culty. Obviously AA was playing this like very positive role in her life, but still it was like impossible not to notice the role that the language played in changing her life and in, you know, affiliating her with this new group, this like very tight-knit, you know, ideologically bound group. And I was like, oh, I should write a book about the language of cults. And that's how it kind of came to me.
Well, it's true. Like, we could use the cult metaphor for anything where people have jargon. Like, the, you know, like,
Academia does a very similar thing.
Yeah,
for sure.
Cult, right? We can definitely use that. Yeah.
Actually, it's so funny. When I was first reaching out to sources for my proposal, and I was reaching out to sociologists and linguists, they, you know, more than one of them was like, actually, you know, some of this cultish influence shows up in academia. And it's true in the point of the book, because I talk about this wide spectrum of cultish groups, not just the Jonestowns and the Scientologies, but also
multi-level marketing groups and SoulCycle and social media gurus. You know, I'm talking about this wide spectrum of cultish groups to show that cultish influence shows up in our everyday lives. We're all under it to some degree. And the most powerful tool that cultish groups and gurus have is language. And it's so powerful in part because it is invisible and it influences us without us really noticing it.
So you bring up, like, you talk about these less wide swath of cultish groups. And I assume you use that terminology because you don't really want to be like, well, they're for sure cults. But how are you defining cults?
I mean, it's really tricky. Like, over the course of writing this book, the definition for cult did not become clearer, but just more nebulous and hazier. I don't really have a hard and fast definition for the word cult, and neither do a lot of the cult scholars that I talked to for the book. It's just one of these words that's become, well, it's never had like an academic definition when talking about like fringe religions, new religions. The etymology and like history of the word cult is really interesting. You know, it comes from a Latin root, that meant like homage paid to divinity. And then it evolved, the word cult evolved to mean just a sort of like religious classification, like sect. And it didn't really acquire these dark, dark undertones that we now associate with it until really like the Manson family murders in Jonestown. Before then, because we live in this like puritanical Protestant society, people tried to, you know, like Protestants and higher ups tried to infuse the word cult with this sense that these fringe religions or these non-Christian religions were like charlatans and quacks and con artists and sinners. But cults weren't really like a national threat or like a priority for most people. Not until the Manson murders and Jonestown did everybody suddenly develop this fear of cults. But not all groups that have been or could be described as cults are any more dangerous or whack than the better accepted religions. And there are all these jokes that religious scholars make that, you know, cult plus time equals religion. There are no, you know, sharp boundaries separating cult from religion, from culture. So yeah, I mean, for me, like it's one of these words whose meaning can completely change depending on the context. Like, because of course, as soon as the word cult became this national symbol of fear, it also became cool. And around the 70s, that's when terms like cult classic and cult following developed. And so now there's sort of this like perverse sexiness surrounding the word cults. Like when I worked in the beauty industry, the word cult was invoked all the time as like a marketing buzzword, like this cult followed product or like join the cult of Glossier or whatever it was. So yeah, I mean, I don't really have a definition of the word cult that applies across the board. My point is that when we're discussing, you know, fringe or mainstream, ideologically bound social groups or sociopolitical groups or spiritual groups, we have to get more specific about what we're talking about because the word cult doesn't provide enough information. It's like, are we just talking about a fairly harmless alternative religion or a fairly harmless secular group? Or are we talking about something more dangerous than that? And if so, we need to address that specifically because the word cult does not provide enough information.
Yeah, I mean, you have the difference between like the Branch Davidians versus like people using it for Lululemon or SoulCycle. And although Lululemon is kind of
skeptical. Yeah,
but importantly, like cults fall on a spectrum. So it's not like there's this binary where something is either a cult or not, or something is either an evil cult or a good cult. Cultishness, for better or for worse, can show up in all of these tight-knit groups. And so Lululemon is somewhere on the spectrum, and the Branch Davidians were more toward the destructive end of the spectrum. But we're, you know, we're all a member of some group that's on the spectrum somewhere.
Oh, sure. Carrie, do you... Well, I think this place is everywhere, but did you ever eat at Loving Hut in Phoenix?
Yeah, Loving Hut is part of a part of this cult.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember the name of the cult, but anyway, yeah. You walk in and there's like the leader of the cult on the TV.
Oh, wow. And it just plays on repeat.
It plays on repeat But the weird thing is they do, that's it. That's the entire proselytization that they do in the space. Otherwise, they just give you delicious vegan
food.
So
good.
So I don't care.
Yeah.
But if they were like Scientology, where they're like trying to like pull you in at every second, I would feel differently about it.
So there's this like long list of criteria or requirements that, you know, people might try to come up with to define what a cult is or what a dangerous cult is. And there's no, it's not like there's a universal list of criteria. Like, I think, you know, for me, when a cult starts to become, well, okay, I'll say on my podcast that I just launched, which is like a very lighthearted yet journalistic, sort of pop culture cult podcast. We will pick a cult of the week and discuss it, invite on guests, talk to, you know, members of the so-called cult to try to figure out whether it is a live your life, a watch your back, or a get the fuck out level cult.
Oh my God, I love
so,
it.
You know, that's kind of, in it, that's kind of a cheeky way to categorize these groups, but
yeah, it's a fuck, marry, kill.
Yeah, it's which is a game we play a lot on the podcast. But yeah, no, totally. Like it, you know, it. I don't think it is healthy to write off all sort of like weird, kooky, woo-woo, metaphysical, irrational groups as blatantly evil, because we as humans are communal by nature, and we crave engaging in rituals with other people doing the same, and I think there is a healthy way to do it. But there are like certain red flags where you're like, maybe this is going from a live your life to a watch your back, or going from a watch your back to a get the fuck out level. And I think what you were saying, when there's this missionary aspect, and it's a part of the cult's protocols to go out and try to recruit other people in a really sinister and deceptive way, that's one red flag. And there are many, and not all cults have all of the red flags. For example, like we think of one, you know, classic criterion for cults as having like a single charismatic guru, like an ill-intentioned charismatic guru. But I think we can all agree, or most of us can agree, that QAnon is an extremely destructive cultish group, but there is no singular charismatic guru with a face assembling everyone around them in QAnon. So like it doesn't meet that criterion. There's not like a mathematical formula for this stuff.
Yeah. You're talking about like in the beauty world, like join this cult follower, or you know, like cult classic, all of these ways that we use the word cult. I have this like division in my head where I always mean cult as a pejorative, but for some reason I am complete, like cult following is just completely disassociated from that in my head, because I can use that just fine and not mean something pejorative. Do you, like, what's going on there?
Well, I think, I mean, I'm sure you know this, like, we as conversationalists are extremely savvy at being able to pick up on the stakes and context of what a word really means when invoked in a particular sentence or in a particular conversation. And so we know that pretty automatically, and of course there's room for misunderstanding, especially on the internet, but in face-to-face conversation, like people can pretty easily pick up that when you call that restaurant a cult, well, I don't know enough about that restaurant, but when we say academia is a cult, or when we say that SoulCycle is a cult, we mean it in a sort of hyperbolic way. And we know pretty automatically that the risks on the table are not like death, or, you know, being completely isolated from your family, or, you know, that sort of thing. And I think like this goes to the same can be applied to, say, using the word prison as a metaphor. Like when I was in high school, I used to call my school a prison. But people knew that I wasn't actually being locked up in a cell. It was just kind of a metaphor. And so I think that's how cult is being used, in a sort of metaphorical way. And you can kind of like cherry pick pretty naturally and automatically what about a cult is applying to academia or SoulCycle and what isn't.
This idea of isolating, how can we use language to isolate? There's this term that you used along with like semantic stops. You know what I'm... communicative,
like, the thought terminating cliche.
Yes, can we talk
thought terminating cliches?
Can we please talk about thought terminating cliches? Because
yeah,
I was just like, we use those all the time, and we're manipulated by those all the time. So what is that?
Totally. So throughout the book, I break down these different linguistic techniques that cultish leaders from Jim Jones to Jeff Bezos to Peloton instructors use to do all sorts of things in order to create and maintain power in various ways. And one of the most interesting ones is this concept of thought-terminating cliches. I did not coin this term. It was coined in the early 50s by this psychologist named Robert J. Lifton. And it describes...
Your book says.
Oh, 61.
Yeah.
Okay, 1961. There it is. Yeah, so there are these stock sayings that are easily memorized, easily repeated, and they are aimed at sort of shutting down independent thinking or questioning or thought in general. So thought-terminating cliches are by no means exclusive to cultish groups. They imbue our everyday lives, and some of the thought-terminating cliches that we might hear day-to-day are... it is what it is, or boys will be boys, or everything happens for a reason, or it's all in God's plan. And thought-terminating cliches are really compelling because they alleviate cognitive dissonance. You know, like it's work to have to hold two conflicting ideas in your mind at the same time and navigate that and reason with that. And a thought-terminating cliche kind of lets you off the hook. It tells you, like, you don't have to think about this anymore. And this can get dangerous when an ill-intentioned guru is invoking them, because when you're in this cultish group and you have a question about a certain ritual or a certain protocol, or you want to express pushback in any way, they can just whip out one of these stock sayings that you've been taught, and that's a way for them to sort of shut you down. So in a New Age group, and there are a lot of sort of like problematic New Agey cultish groups afoot these days, you might hear a thought-terminating cliche come in the form of something like, don't let yourself be ruled by fear. Or dismissing a very valid concern or anxiety as a limiting belief. Keith Raniere of Nexium used to use that one a lot, and I'm sure still does from his prison cell. But, you know, a classic one that was used in Jonestown and essentially by all cultish group in every cultish group in history, including the ones that exist today, are, it's all the media's fault. Like, the media is brainwashed, the media is corrupt, don't believe the media. So you can kind of, like, attune to thought-terminating cliches that are being used in whatever community you're a part of. And if there are too many of them, and if you find that whenever you try to ask a question or express pushback, you're met with a thought-terminating cliche, that is definitely a red flag.
Okay, so how do cult leaders convince people to join their cults in the first place?
Oh, well, because they don't, you know, lead with saying, like, please join my cult. Nobody ever joins a cult. You join a movement or a community that you think is going to solve the world's most urgent problems. That's how all of these groups start, you know, like some leader who speaks with a lot of charisma and confidence, usually like a middle-aged white guy, exactly the type of dude who we would trust with big ideas about God and government. He'll claim that he or she, there are female cult leaders, Gwyneth Paltrow, they'll stand up and they'll claim that they have the solutions to the world's suffering, whether that be, you know, homelessness or racism or COVID. And if you follow them, then you will have access to this transcendent wisdom too, and you'll be a part of this movement to making the world a better place. And you'll have access to this exclusive knowledge. And this is not how it's phrased either. Like, it's phrased much more cleverly than that. And they bait and switch you. I mean, they'll lie to you up front about what your membership is going to require, about what these ideas really are. They'll love bomb you. You know, they'll make you feel incredibly special, incredibly smart. Like, not everybody gets to be a part of this, but like, you have what it takes. I mean, if anybody's seen the WeWork documentary, that's all you need to know. But, you know, something that was really humbling that I learned while researching the book is that the similarities between how you wind up in a toxic one-on-one relationship and how you might end up in a cultish group are strong. Like, those are some major similarities. So if anyone has ever been in a toxic relationship, either with a partner or a friend or a boss,
or a parent,
or a parent,
yeah.
you know what it's like to end up in a cultish group, because out of the jump, or from the jump, they're going to make you feel extremely special and like loved, and like this is your purpose in life. And then as time goes on and the experience deteriorates, or it becomes something really negative or not like you were promised in the beginning, then all these ingrained human reasoning flaws kick into gear. Confirmation bias, sunk cost fallacy. I talk in the book about how brainwashing is this myth. Like, you cannot convince someone to believe something that they on no level want to believe. You can only really give someone license to believe what they already do and then sort of further radicalize them from there. So yeah, you at that point, like, if you are certain number of years into your affiliation with this person, with this group, you're going to start sort of like brainwashing yourself, because you don't want to admit that all of this was a lie and that this was just a mistake, maybe, and that all of this is untrue. So we tend to think of people who wind up in cults as desperate or disturbed or naive. But really, if anything, the commonality I found from cult survivor to cult survivor, and I talked to a lot of them, was this like overabundance of idealism, this like faith that this one person, that this one group really had the answers. If you're like an overly cynical person, you might die alone, but you won't end up in a cult like that.
Right. Yeah, well, I'm pretty cynical, so. this also reminds me of like how QAnon works. So they actually end up completely brainwashing themselves, because it's all online and it's all like you do your own research, and like so you find the thread that's going to convince you the best, because you're doing your own research.
Totally.
No one is giving you a list of things to look at.
And actually, speaking of thought terminating cliches, a classic one in QAnon is I did my research, or do your research.
Yeah. Do your research, yeah.
Of course, research to them is this like DIY internet rabbit hole thing where like who knows what sources they're finding. They're just like on YouTube or 4chan or like wherever they are. And this is something that a lot of these New Age groups or conspiritualist groups, that's a portmanteau of conspiracy theory and spirituality, and that's a lot of what we're seeing right now online, is the marriage of conspiracy theory ideology and New Age ideology. So a lot of what these groups do and have always done in groups like Scientology and NXIVM, etc., is that they'll take these words that have a very specific meaning in certain scientific fields, and they'll twist them slowly and deliberately to infuse them with these cultish metaphysical meanings. So even a word like research, which like, you know, we as like everyday people have a certain definition in mind of what research is. It's when you look into reputable sources in order to learn more about a subject. But because in QAnon or in QAnon offshoots, they are conditioned not to trust mainstream media, not to trust academia. Research for them is this totally different thing. And yeah, a lot of these cultish groups will redefine scientific terms from valence and engram. Those are Scientology terms that have real meanings in other fields, to research, and even the word doctor in conspiritualist circles means something different. So it's really a mindfuck.
Yeah.
It is a mindfuck. When I first realized what was really going on with the QAnon people, like, yeah, they're doing their own research, but also they only look at the things that they find compelling. So if
right.
they think that JFK Jr. is definitely dead, then they're just going to ignore that line of inquiry, and they're not even going to be like, maybe this, all of this is wrong.
Yeah, and we all do that to some degree. Like,
course,
confirmation
yes.
bias is this.
It's real.
It's this fallacy that, like, not even the smartest, most logical people can resist. Like, it is in us. And it takes work to push back against that. And if you don't want to, then it's very easy not to. And what's, you know, kind of dangerous about the internet is that algorithms are like the ultimate confirmation bias encourager. So what algorithms will do by design is send you down rabbit holes so that you become a more extreme believer in something you already believed. And that's what forms these ideological sects online. It's why, like, someone who is deeply entrenched in QAnon ideology and maybe someone who is deeply entrenched in, like, social justice ideology cannot even speak to each other because they are living in different worlds online.
Yeah. Wow. It's quite fascinating to watch, actually. I'm like, why are you bothering fighting with these people? They don't understand you.
Yeah.
I just block them.
Yeah. No, totally. And it's kind of upsetting because, like, we're all, like, flesh and bone with, like, silly little limited brains. And we, you know, we should be able to connect with one another. But the internet and COVID in particular has driven us apart ideologically. And I actually recently, for another project that I'm working on, talked to this really fascinating mis- and disinformation scholar named Elizabeth Creaston. And she studies, like, conspiracy theories, anti-vax stuff, QAnon stuff. And she studies, like, how to communicate with those people. She develops, like, counter strategies for, like, how to talk to people who are just, like, so far gone. Yeah, it was really interesting to talk to her. I you know, I don't provide a lot of service in the book for, like, here's a guide to how to talk to someone who's in a cult. That's not what my book is about. But I did publish a Medium piece recently talking about three things never to say to someone who might be involved with a cult. And what I can say is, if you know someone who you think is involved with a cult, definitely don't tell them they're in a cult. Because that's going to trigger them. Like you were saying, it's this judgment, right? Like, people don't want to feel like they're being judged, even though it's so tempting to be like, you're in a cult. Like, that's what this is. Like, you want to name it. They're not going to be receptive to that. It's not useful to tell them they're brainwashed. And frustratingly, it's not useful to quote some reputable source at them because they have been conditioned not to trust that. And then they're going to think you're brainwashed by the media or academia or whatever it is. So it's so counterintuitive, but yeah, wild stuff.
I just personally know that I could never deprogram anyone, so I don't bother trying. And I applaud those who can and do because it is hard.
Yeah, no, it's like I don't want to say it's a futile effort because I don't think it is, but I think it is just, it is near impossible to convince one person, much less a whole bunch of people en masse, to convince something or to believe something that they just don't want to believe, you know?
Yeah, no, it has to be, I think, an individual thing, one-on-one, and you already have to have a pretty good relationship. Otherwise, I don't think it works.
Or you just have to, like, coexist with them. That's the thing. It's like, if you know someone who's affiliated with a group from Nexium to QAnon or whatever it is, like, you just have to keep them in your life because slowly but surely, like, just you kind of getting in their head might convince them that there's, like, a wrinkle in this belief system that they've been so attached to. And then they'll, like, sort of deprogram themselves.
You know? Yeah. Yes.
So you also talk about, and you mentioned it before, that we're kind of conditioned by society, at least our society in the U.S., to be take white middle-aged men as the authority on whatever, because white supremacy and just, you know, and you even you reference Lindy West's chapter in The Witches Are Coming, Ted Bundy wasn't charming, are you high, which I thought was hilarious because we're having this, like, time right now where there's so many Netflix movies and specials on Ted Bundy, and I think that, you know, some people that are not white are like, why do all of you people think he's so charming? What's going on?
Yeah.
I wonder, is there, like, race differences in cult? Did you look at that at all?
Definitely. Well, I was actually just talking about this yesterday on another podcast. But no, it's a really important question because it is impossible not to notice that the vast majority of people who get involved with particularly these new age groups, which is what a lot of cults are these sort of like appropriative Eastern / occultic / indigenous takes on what fundamentally is just still kind of like evangelical ideology. A lot of those people are white because they're sort of like ex-Protestants, ex-Christians who are rejecting the sort of like oppressive or uninteresting religion that they grew up with and now are sorely lacking community. They don't feel like they have a culture. They don't feel like they have institutional support living in the United States where we don't have universal health care. And if you're poor, kind of too bad. And if you lose your job, like the government is not going to be there to support you, et cetera. A lot of like white ex-Christian middle-class Americans kind of feel like existentially high and dry, if you will. And so they end up turning to these alternative groups to fill the void that folks who have a better built-in sense of community support might not turn to. And of course, like white privilege gets factored into the matter because, you know, if you, I don't know, just like the mindset that you have to be in to place all of your faith and money into this one guru and to believe that you can contribute to solving all the world's issues, that's a pretty privileged point of view. And so, yeah, I mean, you can definitely find that, you know, middle-class ex-Christian white folks are those most attracted to New Age ideology. Jonestown was an exception, and I write about that at length in the book. You know, most of the folks, and I didn't realize this before I started looking into it, most of the folks who died in the Jonestown massacre, which was a coerced suicide slash murder, not this, you know, totally sensational mass suicide where everybody drank the Kool-Aid like it's portrayed in the media. It wasn't even Kool-Aid anyway.
It wasn't.
different brand. And you 100% had to, you know, you had no choice, essentially. You either had to drink this thing or you would be injected with it or you would be shot trying to run away. Like, it was a really dark thing. But Jim Jones, he was sort of this, like, Machiavellian master code switcher. And he targeted Black folks, and that's the majority of folks who died in Jonestown were Black, majority Black women, actually. And he targeted Black San Francisco Americans in a way that was really diabolical. He promised to have this solution to racism and class disparity in the United States that looked really legit because he had affiliations with all the right people, the Black Panthers, Angela Davis, etc. And he learned how to meet people on their linguistic level. So he would, he was a mentee of Father Divine, the famous pastor. He could talk to everyone from, like, you know, privileged white, college students or college graduates who wanted, you know, who were impressed by him quoting Nietzsche, but he could also talk to, you know, middle-aged Black women who were active in the San Francisco church scene, and sort of mimic the lilt of a Pentecostal preacher. And, almost all of the Jonestown survivors that I spoke with told me that upon first meeting him, it really felt like he was speaking their language. Like, he was really speaking uniquely to them. And that was quite exceptional by and large. He was really widely read, widely studied, smart dude.
That's funny because don't we mostly think of, like, he was really speaking my language as more metaphorical, but here we're talking about him actually
it's literal.
Code-switching. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, it is literal. Like, he would use terms that white people were not supposed to know, and he was able to pull it off because it looked like he walked the walk. He started out as an integrationist pastor. He had adopted many children of color. Like, he seemed legit. He stuck out. And I'm leaning on a lot of the research that the feminist scholar Sikivu Hutchinson has done on this topic. And I had no idea the complex racial dynamics of the People's Temple until I started looking into it. But largely ex-Christian middle-class white Americans are the folks who join these, like, New Age fringe movements, I guess.
Oh yeah, when I read that part, I was like, you know, I joke about, you know, when I met Carrie, she introduced me to feminism. So if she happened to be a cult leader, I would have been in a cult. But otherwise, I don't think
under the right circumstances be, and at the
anyone,
yeah.
Right? You know,
yeah.
Yeah, I was particularly lonely and isolated at that point. And, you know, if, you know, was perfect. But, well, it wasn't perfect because she's not a cult leader, no matter what anyone says about you, Carrie.
Thank God. And I'd be fun to see someone try to call me that.
What's the most dangerous way language has been used to promote ideas that are harmful? Or is it just like all of it together is just this one big huge clusterfuck? Or was there something that you noticed particularly?
Yeah, I think it's all the techniques compounded. I mean, the one cult language technique that I was especially excited to investigate for the book is glossolalia, or speaking in tongues. Just because I've always been so fascinated by that ever since I watched the documentary Jesus Camp when I was like 14 or something like that. Yeah. And it was really cool. I got to talk to like the only modern glossolalia linguist, which was really cool. I think his name is Paul DeLacy.
I actually know him in person.
Oh, really? Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it seems like he kind of like fell into being a glossolalia scholar.
He did.
But it was pretty cool to investigate that. And I've just always been like so, I've just like rubbernecked like mad at the practice of glossolalia because I'm just like, what is going on? Like, is it a threat to me? And it is interesting because when someone speaks glossolalia, they do kind of enter a dissociative state, which is not inherently bad. And we enter dissociative states in small ways all the time, like when you stare at a bonfire, you know? But what's dangerous is, and what was dangerous, like in that movie Jesus Camp, which is about like this super radical, like evangelical Christian summer camp where these kids are learning how to like take back America for Christ or something. What can be dangerous about glossolalia is that, like, under the influence of a pernicious religious leader or guru, this glossolalia experience can be loaded with a lot of meaning that actually isn't there, and you can, like, have trouble separating what's real from what's not real, and someone can really exert a lot of power over you by loading this. It's like the ultimate form of loaded language, which is another form of cultish language that I talk about in the book. I don't know if glossolalia is like the most dangerous form of cult language out there, but it was definitely like one of the most fascinating parts of the book to investigate. I think, yeah, definitely all of it compounded together. Like, you need the us, them labeling, and just like buzzwords in general. Like, you need the exclusive jargon in order to make people who are part of this group feel elite, and in order to make everyone else seem like a villain. You need the thought terminating cliches, you need the loaded language, like, you need all of it. And the more sort of like features of cultish language that a group uses, the more red flags you might be seeing.
What's a quick example of loaded language?
Oh my gosh. Well, one of the first examples that I discovered in the book, I was talking before about how a cult will take existing English words and twist them to have a different meaning. And that doesn't just go for like scientific terminology, it goes for regular words in the English language too. They'll take them and load them with really high emotional stakes and emotional charge in order to manipulate people's behavior. And one of the first examples was, I think the very first interview I did for the whole book was with this young woman who had left this group called 3HO, the Happy, Healthy, Holy organization, which is a Kundalini yoga cult, and has a lot of, you know, freaky practices and was very oppressive, or it still is because it exists. Actually, they're the group that owns Yogi Tea, if you know the brand of tea, Yogi Tea.
I read that and I was like, well, I won't anymore.
Cultishness is everywhere. But I remember she told me about this example where the 3HO redefined the word old soul in a really emotionally interesting way. So old soul to an everyday English speaker is a compliment. It means you're like wise beyond your years. It's something you would like to be called. But in this Kundalini yoga group, it meant somebody who had reincarnated and reincarnated and gone through life after life after life and could never get it right. They were on a quote-unquote very low, low vibration. And this is, you know, a type of New Age rhetoric that's used all over the place. Vibrations, frequencies, whatever. And so old soul could be used to trigger dread and fear. It could also almost be used as a threat. Like, you don't want it. Like, how dare you break this rule or that rule? And there were all these rules. You had to wake up at 5 a.m. You had to, you know, you couldn't eat meat, like all this stuff. Well, I don't know. I'm vegan. But yeah, there were all these rules and protocols. And if you broke any of them, they could throw old soul in your face as a threat, as this thing that you might become. And she was telling me how to this day, like years after having left, every time she hears the word old soul, she like shudders because that emotional charge is like still in her body, you know?
Yeah, I found that part really interesting. I was like, this, I mean, I don't really like the term old soul because I think it sounds silly, but yeah. But to have that dread associated with it, I was like, oh boy, I'm glad I don't have that at least.
And once you know what loaded language is, you can, you know, you can start identifying examples of it from your life, you know?
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about cults for, I would say all day, but really, I mean, for a year straight and not get bored.
Because... And I have been.
Yeah, you really have.
Yeah, you are deep in it. were there times deep where you it. Actually were, like, you were just like, I can't believe that I'm surrounded by so much language that is meant to manipulate me.
Yeah, but like, actually, oddly enough, I thought that writing this book would make me this very like misanthropic, paranoid person. Like, cults are everywhere. But really, it actually just kind of made me like a softer person because I'm like, you know what? We're fundamentally irrational. We fundamentally, as human beings, crave connection. And sometimes we really like to bond over weird shit. And I think that that is fine. And I don't, like, judge that as much anymore. What I judge is when these gurus and leaders and, like, clout-chasing, ill-intentioned people at the top exploit others and use others very, like, innocent craving for community and connection to, you know, benefit them and only them. Like, I resent and judge that. But I, yeah, actually the book has like made me a little, has definitely made me like more compassionate toward cultish ideas. And I think there is a way to indulge in that sort of thing while at the same time remaining skeptical and safe and healthy and connected to reality. And actually, it's interesting, like something I learned toward the end of my research is that some of history's greatest minds, like Carl Sagan, when given a personality test, would score off the charts in both conscientiousness and open-mindedness. So like Carl Sagan, decades ago, when it was really edgy and considered quite culty to believe in the possibility of extraterrestrial life, he was willing to entertain that idea. But he was not so open to every wacky idea that crossed his desk that he was willing to believe that, like, a UFO had already landed on Earth and was, like, leaving, like, crop circles and whatever. So I actually think it's good to be open-minded to weird ideas and to not judge other people for weird ideas within limits. Like, it's important to have, like, a ritual space to engage in whatever spirituality you're into. And then to leave it and to be able to think independently and rationally and make decisions based on, like, facts.
Yeah, you know how wacky people thought the Wright brothers were.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it without too much conscientiousness, too much skepticism stifles innovation and just stifles, like, not to sound too earnest, but like the magical parts of the human experience, you know, like we're not built to be these robots. Like, we want to do weird things and believe in weird things. And I think to a point that's okay. And that's good.
Yeah. But Carrie Wright, robots need love too, I've heard.
Robots need love too.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
Really appreciate you coming to talk with us about a book.
Of course.
We'll see you in about, what, 2 years for your next
book? Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much. And yeah. We always say, don't be an asshole.
We would like to thank our newest patrons, Mariana Montez, Edward Delmonico, who is a former student of mine.
Aww, I'm so happy. That's so thank sweet.
You. Yeah. Yeah. And actually, he and two other former students and I co-wrote a chapter on our conlang experience. Yeah. So, yeah. And then Olivia Buchan.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
You know, every time there's more than one, I'm just like, that's so lovely. Why are people so lovely?
Yes, it's
amazing. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.